Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. Today's guest speaker is Rachel LaPonce, who is the clinical manager for the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Linda. Happy to be here. This is very exciting. I think this is your first podcast, is it not?
Yes, our very first podcast, and we'll be broadcasting each month with a new topic. So you are our first guest speaker.
Awesome. So great to be here.
What article are you going to be reviewing with us today, Rachel?
So the article I've chosen is called Idiopathic Pulmonary Fibrosis, and it's a review of the disease, the pharmacological and non-pharmacological strategies. And the article has a focus on symptoms, function, and health-related quality of life. It is from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, volume 59, and the date of the journal is June 6, 2020. This article was written by Dimitri Rosenberg, a physician, Nicole Sitzer, a physician, Sandra Porter, a pharmacist, Andrea Weiss, a physician, Rebecca Coleman, a physician, Darlene Reed, physiotherapist, Shane Shapira, a physician, Jolene Fisher, a physician, and Kirsten Wetland, a physician.
Fantastic. And can you tell us all why you chose this article?
So I had a look at many different articles, but for today's topic, I thought it would be interesting to share a little bit of information around idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. It's not something you hear about often, but it is very present. And despite several advances in treatment, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis remains a progressive symptomatic and terminal disease in patients that are not candidates for lung transplantation. With disease progression, IPF is what I'll refer to it when I talk about this article. IPF, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, often leads to a number of different symptoms, including dyspnea, cough, anxiety, and depression. And palliative care is very appropriate to support these patients. So that's really why I chose this article. It's a non-malignant disease, and I felt we should know a little bit more about it.
And what are some of the challenges in looking after people with IPF?
So there are many challenges looking after anybody who has a life-limiting illness. But for the purpose of this article, palliative care in this patient group requires the person who's looking after them to have an understanding of the clinical characteristics of IPF, what the comorbidities are, what the common medications are that are used to treat it and manage it, what the non-pharmacological strategies are that could be used to improve daily function, and the person's rating of their quality of life. This article itself helps give us some strategies on how to manage it, and also tells us a little bit about the effectiveness of those treatments on the symptoms.
Rachel, why did you like this article?
Well, I liked this particular article because I found it was a very straightforward read. It was in language that I could understand. It was current. It's from June 2020. And it highlights information about something that I didn't really know a lot about. This article, this review on IPF is meant for a palliative audience, and it highlights the disease trajectory. It highlights the comorbidities of this disease. It highlights the pharmacological and non-pharmacological management strategies and their effects on the symptoms. It gives me an understanding of the function of someone who has IPF and the quality of their life and some of the things that they may experience.
So let's get into a bit of what IPF is. Can you tell us a little bit about it based on what you have learned in this article?
Sure. So as I was reading the article, what I did find, according to the article, was that idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, or IPF, I'll refer to it as, is an interstitial lung disease, and it's characterized by disease progression and a functional decline. Patients with this disease typically present in their 60s and 70s. Men are more commonly affected than women with this disease, and its prevalence and incidence is quite variable depending on where the person lives and what sort of population things that they're using to see it. It is present in literature in people in North America and in Europe, and they have studies to talk about it. That's about it.
Okay. And what are some of the common symptoms experienced by people who have IPF?
So in reading this article, I found that some of the common symptoms for those who have IPF include dyspnea, which is a subjective reporting of feeling short of breath. They often have a non-productive cough, and they often experience fatigue.
And can you tell us why it is challenging to identify when to initiate a palliative approach to care for people who have IPF?
So with anything that is outside of the cancer realm, it a lot of times is difficult to prognosticate because the trajectories are very different. Despite several new advances in treatment, IPF remains a progressive disease with an unknown etiology, so we don't know why it particularly happens. And it often has a poor prognosis with an average survival about 3 years from the time a person is diagnosed. Initially, disease progression with IPF is often insidious, which means it's gradually progresses. And the disease is unpredictable, with some patients developing an acute deterioration that happens fast and rapidly after a period of stable disease progression. And then the older age at the time that they're diagnosed, smoking history, lower body mass index, and evidence of disease in their lungs based on x-rays is also an indication that their prognosis is not as good. Respiratory exacerbations are present in IPF and require hospitalizations at times. They're uncommon in someone who has mild disease. They're more prevalent in patients that have more advanced disease. When someone has more advanced disease and they do require frequent hospitalizations, this again is another indication of a high burden of disease, high burden of symptoms, and also increases the mortality.
Do people with IPF have other health concerns?
Yeah, they do. Many people with IPF develop or have other chronic conditions such as COPD, cardiovascular disease. Some of them may have underlying lung cancers. Some of them may have what we call obstructive sleep apnea. Some of them have pulmonary hypertension. And I found it interesting in this article, they said that pulmonary hypertension was found in about 30 to 50% of patients that had advanced IPF. These comorbidities also contribute to the disease progression and the symptom burden. And the more comorbidities you have, oftentimes the clinical deterioration is riddled with more symptom burden and also more of a rapid pace, and increases the need for care and hospital, and increases medical costs associated with having to manage and intervene.
So as a nurse in palliative care, you have many years of experience. What was something you read in the article that was not a surprise working in palliative care?
So I did find it interesting when I was reading the article, they talked about a retrospective study from a center in the US that talked about referral rates for patients with IPF. And It's not surprise. It wasn't surprising to me. And it also probably confirmed for me that we do a better job in referring cancer patients to palliative care than we do with those that have non-cancer related life-limiting illnesses. So in this one study, they found that 13.5% of 828 patients with IPF were referred to palliative care. So the patients that were in that 13% that were referred were older, had a greater number of comorbidities, so they had high symptom burden, they lived closer to the referring center. However, even though palliative care involvement was found to improve the ability of people to stay home, it's a very low number of people with this disease that were referred. So in that study, they found that 44% of patients palliative care. So when they were referred to palliative care, if they weren't referred, 60% died in hospital. When they were referred to palliative care, 44% died in hospital, which means that more were able to stay out in the community where a lot of times people wish to be. This is different compared to some of the referral rates that we see in oncology patients, where rates have been reported to be about 26 to 33% of those with oncology diagnoses are referred to palliative care, whereas in this study, they found only 13.5% with IPF were referred to palliative care.
So from my previous reading, I understand that IPF has a clinical course that is quite variable. Would you say that that is correct?
I would agree with you, Linda. The clinical course of IPF is variable. Some patients progress slowly, whereas others have a rapidly deteriorating course of their illness. Respiratory exacerbations are very typical, as I said already, and they're characterized by a sudden increase in the need for oxygen. They often have experience a subjective worsening of their dyspnea, their shortness of breath, and often when x-rays are done, they can see changes in those x-rays, all indicating, a rapid deterioration.
Are there specific disease indicators of decline, or are there other factors that a person may have that make the prognosis more limited?
There certainly is, Linda. So there are several other factors for IPF exacerbations that can sort of trigger them, or not so much cause and effect, but if they're present, then you're not surprised that there is an exacerbation. So when someone has a decline in their forced vital capacity, when they have those respiratory spirometer tests, their forced vital capacity is less than what it was before. Those that have had thoracic surgical procedures are certainly those more at risk. Those that have a prior history of an acute exacerbation are more at risk for another. Those that are a younger age sometimes have more brittle disease at the time of diagnosis. Those that have a greater body mass index or the presence of other comorbidities such as coronary artery disease or pulmonary hypertension are certainly those that are at higher risk.
So you have mentioned some of the common comorbidities. Can you just go over that a little bit more with me, Rachel, about the common comorbidities that accompany IPF?
Sure. So there are a number. According to this article, there are both comorbidities that are common and that occur both in the parenchymal, they call it, or the extra parenchymal etiology. So they come from within the lung itself or outside of the lungs themselves. So important pulmonary comorbidities that increase the symptoms of IPF is if someone has pulmonary hypertension, if they have lung cancer, if they have emphysema and pulmonary fibrosis. So those illnesses or extra comorbidities that are outside of the lung that contribute to not so much of a well disease trajectory are those that have a previous history of blood clots, those that have congestive heart failure, those that have coronary artery disease or GERD, those that have mental health concerns such as anxiety and depression can also impact the disease trajectory.
And what are some of the pharmacological treatments for IPF?
So there are two medications that this article lists as pharmacological treatments for IPF. And please excuse me when I'm saying them because I'm a little bit tongue-tied when I say them. Pirfenidone is one of them and nintedanib is another. So both of these medications, pirfenidone and nintedanib, have been shown to attenuate the decline in the IPF symptoms. So what that means is it slows the decline a little bit of the disease progression and severity. So pirfenidone may help reduce mortality, whereas nintedanib may decrease the risk of exacerbations. They are both considered anti-fibrotic agents, but unfortunately, they have not been shown to help with the respiratory symptoms of IPF, and they also have not been reported to impact the rating of quality of life for patients with IPF. So yes, they do help slow the progression of the disease, or so they've found that they slow the progression and help reduce mortality. But as far as the symptom burden that people experience when they have this, these two medications have not been found to really impact that too much.
Okay, so can we speak a little bit more about pirfenidone? Can you explain to me what that is and what the side effects of this medication are?
Sure. So from my reading, I found that pirfenidone is an oral anti-fibrotic agent that has been shown when they did testing on animals to have an anti-inflammatory or anti-fibroblastic effect on the extracellular matrix. So it's recommended that it be used, and has been found to decrease. I'll just go back here. So the recommendations for pirfenidone used is based on the results of a 3-phase clinical trial that demonstrated that the forced FVC decline was reduced across all 3 studies. So it was found that in 3 trials, it showed that a decreased proportion of individuals experiencing decline benefited from using pirfenidone. So death was not as imminent when it was used. There was a reduction in mortality after it was started at the 1-year mark, according to some of the studies. The most common side effect of using pirfenidone is people may experience a rash, they may experience photosensitivity, they may experience some nausea, some diarrhea, some abdominal discomfort, some tummy upset, loss of appetite, and some fatigue. And I'm just, so they found that in reducing the dose of the drug or discontinuing it, It often caused some gastrointestinal side effects as well. They found that if it was used after meals, that it sometimes reduced some of the GI side effects. It was also found to cause a little bit of constipation, some itchiness, some dry skin, some hyperpigmentation, headache and weakness at times as well.
So that explains that drug fairly well. Could you also do the same for nintedanib and explain what that drug is and what its side effects are?
Sure. So nintedanib is, according to what I read, is a tyrosine receptor blocker that intervenes between the fibrogenic growth factor and decreases the rate of progression of IPF. So it has anti-fibroblastic activity because it inhibits the endothelial growth factors from developing. So in clinical trials, it has shown that the main benefit of nintedanib is that it intervenes in the decline of lung function. So it slows the progression of declining lung function. So it kind of slows the disease progression a little bit. And as much like the other medication, they did two parallel phase 3 trials to evaluate how effective this drug was and how safe it was to use. And they found that it did significantly demonstrate a reduction in the FVC decline. So meaning that the person's lung function the decline in the lung function wasn't as aggressive when someone was started on this medication. Now, some of the side effects with this one, as with pirfenidone, is diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, some elevated liver function tests, and those are some of the most common ones. Diarrhea, for instance, was reported in more than 60% of patients. They did find that the symptoms of diarrhea improved when the dose was reduced a little bit or when anti-diarrhea medications like loperamide were used. I think that's about it.
So what I'm hearing is that both of these drugs have actually been found to reduce the effect or progression of IPF, but do not improve symptoms. So could you tell us maybe what can be used to manage the symptoms associated with IPF?
Sure. And I did find, you know, it's too bad that those medications don't help with the symptoms at the same time that they're helping with the disease progression. But we certainly have other medications that can be used that we have in our back pocket to help. Opioids, for instance, are, very typically used for those that experience dyspnea. And as in people with IPF, opioids are also used for the management of dyspnea. And it's becoming more recognized and used for those with advanced interstitial lung disease. There's been many studies that have shown that low dose opioids or even high dose opioids that have been prescribed appropriately tend to decrease the experience of dyspnea and have not increased hospitalizations and have not increased mortality when used correctly. Thalidomide is also another medication that is an immune modulator, and it's also an anti-fibrotic agent that improves pulmonary fibrosis. There were some studies done in mice models, and they found that the role of thalidomide in managing a cough was also helpful. They found that thalidomide improved cough symptoms. And because it improved the cough symptoms, it improved the person's health-related quality of life scales. So people reported that they had better quality of life when their cough symptoms were managed, which certainly makes sense to us. Some of the adverse side effects of using thalidomide is, of course, constipation, and constipation is also present when opioids are used. 36% of patients reported constipation, 27% reported dizziness with the use of thalidomide, 14% reported just general malaise, 5% reported anorexia, and 5% also had asymptomatic bradycardia, which is a low heart rate. So thalidomide also has a 20% chance of increasing a person's experience of drowsiness. So in the palliative care world, there are many medications that we use for symptom management. Many symptoms have medications that cause drowsiness. So the more medications that cause drowsiness, the more drowsiness the more drowsiness the person may experience. So that's just a red flag or an alert that to be conscious of that when putting in multiple medications to manage multiple symptoms, that they all could be contributing to some of those potential side effects like that, like the constipation, like the low appetite, like the drowsiness. So those are the two main ones that I can think of, Linda.
Okay, and so would there be any further drugs that nurses could become familiar with, say, that doctors may prescribe that may not be recommended for IPF, but they use as another mode of treatment?
Yeah, so often in patients with life-limiting illness, we use steroids and things like that. So I did find it interesting that historically glucocorticoids have been used for IPF, but they found that prolonged use of steroids has been shown to increase the risk of infection, which we know, and thus increases the mortality of IPF. So when it's combined with other things like steroid anti-inflammatories or azithromycin, that they should not be routinely used outside of an exacerbation in itself. So they shouldn't be used for long periods of time because of the contraindications and the risks of infection and early mortality. So short-term use of them in acute exacerbations is certainly warranted, but they want to be a little bit more cautious about it, using it long-term. Azithromycin is another one, and non-steroid anti-inflammatories and pulmonary vasodilators are no longer recommended to be used with people with IPF because of their lack of benefit and also their increased morbidity and mortality when combined with prednisone. So they found that non-steroid anti-inflammatories as a treatment in itself was found to be ineffective and didn't reduce the rate of decline in lung function. And when used in combination with, say, pirfenidone, one of those other treatments that are found to decrease the disease progression, they led to increased rates of skin rash and worsening lung function. So it almost counteracts the benefit of what the other is doing. So they are not recommended. They also find that they recommend against the use of pulmonary vasodilators for pulmonary hypertension, because of they found that there's not a great benefit, or there's lack of benefit, and there is greater lung function decline with the use of some of them.
So we've discussed the pharmacological treatment for IPF. What about the non-pharmacological non-pharmacological treatments used for IPF. Could you give us a little bit of information on that?
Sure. So as nurses, and I'm a nurse, we often like to have a focus on the non-medication related treatments that can help with that symptom management, that symptom burden. So there's several ones that can be used for the management of IPF symptoms. Some of them are oxygen supplementation, pulmonary rehab, nutrition, and then obviously transplantation, which is, you know, sort of something that's big and more grand. So the use of oxygen helps improve dyspnea and exercise capacity. Sometimes it allows them to have a little bit more endurance because they become a little less breathless with that supplementation. They found that it's been helpful for those that have nocturnal hypoxemia, which is when you're sleeping, your O2 sats drop. They found that oxygen supplementation can help with that. And so obviously if someone is sleeping better, then their energy throughout the day is better. And sometimes it can help with the daily function of symptoms that they experience in the day. It hasn't been found to improve survival or improve the incidence of pulmonary hypertension at this point, but it's more of a symptom management treatment. If it makes them feel a little bit better, then it is often offered. Those that have other conditions associated with their IPF, like COPD or emphysema, supplemental oxygen has been demonstrated to improve survival because they have low resting oxygen saturations to begin with. And so by supplementing them to what a normal baseline would be, it allows life to be prolonged in that way. But it's a case-by-case basis. It's often not used unless the person is reporting some dyspnea. And, you know, if the person is not hypoxic and doesn't experience any benefit from it, then it's often not used. High flow nasal cannula or high flow oxygen allows a range of oxygen to be delivered that's a little bit higher. And so when someone has IPF and is at the level in which they need something of this capacity, that kind of coincides with some of that goal planning conversations. And we talk about, you know, what is a priority for them and where do we want to go? Where do they need to be in order to be able to have that high flow oxygen? Towards the end of life, patients with IPF may have high oxygen requirements to maintain their oxygen sats. You know, although high oxygen flow rates may help alleviate the symptoms, it's sometimes not a logical consideration if we want to consider the environments in which the person wants to be in. Do they want to remain at home? Do they want to be in hospice care? So that's where I say those goals of care conversations and that advanced care planning in advance to getting to this point are so important. Pulmonary rehab is another thing that's not medication related. Patients with IPF are known to have significant impairments in their physical fitness, their mobility, and their activity levels compared to people without. And so by introducing pulmonary rehab earlier on in their illness trajectory, then that can provide a bit of benefit early on. A pulmonary rehab program for patients with IPF during 8 to 12 weeks has been shown to improve their dyspnea. It has improved their rating of quality of life, and it also has improved their exercise capacity. This, on top of some breathing exercises and some inspiratory muscle training, appears to provide more improvement in exercise tolerance than just doing that exercise training alone. So the combination of working your lungs as well as working your body helps maintain some of that ability to be able to move yourself from point A to point B. Despite significant progress and the acceptance of pulmonary rehab in IPF, there is further research, according to this article, that needs to be done in order to be able to figure out, you know, when is the best time to introduce it? Is there benefit beyond a 1 month interval of that pulmonary rehab? So, you know, it does give us hope that they can investigate further the value of that. Nutrition in itself is not uncommon. Being nutritionally compromised is not uncommon for patients with IPF. Patients experience a decrease in their appetite and often weight loss as their disease progresses. So introducing them to a nutritionist or someone who can give them suggestions on small meals more frequently, some supplements that could be useful would be of benefit. And then lung transplantation was listed in this article as a non-pharmacological treatment. So IPF is becoming a leading indicator for lung transplant internationally. And this has been shown to extend survival. But of course, there obviously would be a strict regime of who would qualify for that and who wouldn't. And it's also suggesting in this article that, you know, even if someone is on the lung transplant list, that is also valuable to introduce a palliative approach to care for that focus on symptom management. At the same time, they're hopeful and planning for that transplant.
So you previously mentioned a little bit about advanced care planning. Can you explain a little bit more about advanced care planning and IPF, and is this actually being done?
Sure. So several barriers have been highlighted as to why some healthcare professionals may be hesitant to have advanced care planning discussions with IPF patients. You know, a lot of times a healthcare provider may be concerned about giving a false perception to the patient that the healthcare team is giving up on them if they're starting to introduce goals of care and, you know, we hope for, but let's plan for this just in case. You don't want to remove the hope that they have. And sometimes there's a fear of doing that. Evidence, according to this article, has demonstrated that most patients with IPF and their caregivers prefer to have advanced care planning discussions earlier on in their disease trajectory. Much like some of the oncology literature, around discussions surrounding disease and its prognosis, they haven't been found to have negative consequences on hope. So the same thought is around patients who have IPF. Having the discussions around disease, having the discussions around prognosis isn't going to impact or have negative consequences on hope, if they're done in a thoughtful manner, in a professional manner, and from those in their care team. It's important to review symptoms. It's important to review coping strategies. It's important to review the prognosis, and it should be revisited with patients on an ongoing basis. There are not a lot of studies specific to IPF patients around advanced care planning, but we know that caregivers play an important role in helping their loved one navigate their journey with their chronic disease, and how that navigation takes place, the management of all of that impacts the outcomes.
Are there any palliative care assessment tools and patient-reported outcome measures that would be helpful or are helpful for people with interstitial lung disease?
Yeah, there are several recently developed assessment tools for interstitial lung disease, which can capture symptoms that the person is experiencing, and it can also capture the rating of quality of life and the individual needs of the patients. Gathering this information as healthcare providers can help inform us and help guide our discussions related to the symptoms and help navigate them with their daily function and link them with appropriate resources. One tool is called the Palliative Care Needs Assessment Tool in interstitial lung disease. This assesses a patient's current state of well-being, and it uses four domains to help triage the needs for palliative care assessment and can be applied in clinical practice for non-palliative care practitioners. So the first domain, so there's four of them, focuses on the well-being of the patient. The second and third domains assess the needs of the caregivers, and the fourth domain helps with triaging the needs for palliative care. So there are several patient-reported outcome measures. One is called PROMS, and that stands for patient-reported outcome measures, that has been used in IPF to evaluate their rating of quality of life and the IPF specific symptoms that they're experiencing, such as dyspnea, cough, depression, and anxiety. So these are questionnaires where they were originally developed for chronic respiratory disease conditions, and they're using them for patients with IPF. They've been validated with IPF populations, and it have been found to allow us to gain a better appreciation of the impact of the disease on the patients and their associated symptoms, and it helps guide our care with them.
So after studying this article, what would you say was a takeaway from it and something that rings true when you think about your palliative care work?
So what rings true is in this article, they talked about a recent study from Canada that demonstrated that multidisciplinary care that is made up of physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, physiotherapists, dietitians, you know, the team that we typically work with, helps. So when people are being cared for with a team approach, it reduces hospital admissions, and it also reduces the use of healthcare resources in the last year of life compared to those that are not receiving a multidisciplinary care approach from a number of different providers. So that team approach, when that team approach is not used, then there's an increased rate of hospitalized admissions. There's an increased rate of resources that are used in the last year of life, which makes sense. It rings true. So what they found was that this multidisciplinary intervention reduced a higher number of patients dying. It resulted in a higher number of patients dying at hospice or at home. So when a multidisciplinary team is involved, 78% of people were able to die in the hospice or die in their home, which means a little over 20% died in hospital. That's much better than, you know, 80% dying in hospital. And we know that a lot of people prefer to be outside of the hospital for end of life. Only 40%, according to this study, 40% that didn't have a multidisciplinary team involved were able to die at home or in hospice. So to me, this is important. It highlights that the preferred place of death for patients with IPF is complex. You know, it may be at home, it may be a hospice setting, or it may be in hospital, depending on what their symptom burden is. But we need to be open to discussing and enabling some of those plans to be in place for what their goals are. Advanced care planning discussions should address the goals of care related to, you know, their ventilatory support. What interventions do they want? How much of those interventions do they want? Where do they need to be to have some of those interventions? So, you know, working in palliative care in my line of work, all of that stuff rings true. You need a team, you need to have those advanced care planning conversation in advance. You need to have those goals of care discussions. You need to talk about the disease trajectory, the symptom burden, et cetera.
So we're nearing the end of our time together, Rachel, but before we go, could you quickly summarize some main highlights from this article?
So just to summarize then, traditionally palliative care has been associated with cancer populations, despite the fact that patients with advanced chronic disease experience similar symptom burdens and worse, reported quality of life. As palliative care advocates working in the field, it's very important for us to integrate and improve the understanding of palliative care with non-malignant diseases like IPF. Palliative care clinicians must familiarize themselves with the new and advanced therapies available to help patients and understand their contribution to, you know, does it improve their rating of quality of life? Does it improve their symptom management? In this article, I found that pirfenidone and nintedanib are antifibrotic drugs that slow the disease progression of IPF, but do not provide improvements in symptom burden, functional status, or the rating of quality of life, which we know is very important as well. And so those do have to be a focus when we're talking palliative care. Many of the previous treatment strategies, including azithromycin, prednisone, and non-steroid anti-inflammatories therapies are no longer used, as they've shown to be either ineffective or sometimes harmful when used in combination with things. The use of opioids can provide symptomatic relief for patients with IPF. The gradual titration and monitoring for side effects of these medications is very, very important and needs to be highlighted. You need a team involved that's actively involved in checking in on these individuals to make sure that what they're using is still effective to the level that is appropriate for the patient, and that there are non-pharmacological strategies that may provide asymptomatic benefit for patients with IPF, but that there's still more research that can be done to improve and validate some of these interventions.
Well, Rachel, I have to say that was an absolutely fantastic review of your article for our first podcast. And I want to thank you so much for the time, effort that you spent to prepare for the podcast and for sharing your wisdom and your expertise with us today.
Thank you.